Okay. I, off the top of my head, really couldn't think of any places, really. So then I thought, wow, is this whole thing suspect? So what I did was I did some reading just on the idea of spiritual gifts, and I limited to myself, just for sake of time, in 1 Corinthians. And if you read pretty much from 1 Corinthians 9 on, you're going to find a lot of passages that speak to or relate to spiritual giftedness. And there, there I found many references to this idea of pursuing spiritual giftedness, like pursuing it, like having a passion about this. So I want to look at just a couple things first. If you've got your Bibles, would you turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 9? And I'm going to look at verses 24 and following. And when I first read this, you may wonder how it fits. And maybe at the end of me reading it, I'll wonder how it fits. But I have a connection in mind. Let's see if it works. So 1 Corinthians 9:24. Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. And everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we in an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air. But I buffet my body, and I make it my slave, lest possibly, after I have preached to others, I myself should be disqualified. So the immediate context of that passage in Paul's writing this letter is talking about laying aside any encumbrance that gets in the way of your growth in grace, that gets in the way of your spiritual development and nourishment, basically the discipleship that we all need to be involved in. And so it also speaks to an intentionality to living. So, you know, I don't just beat the air. So, I mean, you can shadow box if you want to, but all real boxers spend time on a bag. They spend time with another opponent in a ring training. They don't just beat the air. They're very intentional about that. If you want to run the race, or if you want to win the race, you have to be focused, intentional, and really put all your energy towards winning the prize. It's not going to happen accidentally. Even Usain Bolt, when he was the fastest man on earth, was very focused. He couldn't just go out there and wing it, because it was, I mean, he's winning by hundreds of seconds. I think the correlation here is when we're thinking about our spiritual gifts, because he begins to move in chapter 12, Paul is full into an argument on spiritual gifts. But he starts with this idea in chapter 12, verse 1. He says, "Now concerning spiritual gifts, brethren," in other words, he's laying down some basic principles, and then he begins to apply them to certain things. So he applies them to the Lord's Supper in chapter 11, and then chapter 12, 13, and 14, he applies them to spiritual gifts. So I was thinking back going, okay, so there's this idea, first off, is an intentionality to our giftedness. It's a focus. It's a paying attention to what we are trying to accomplish. So it's applying or living in your spiritual gifts in a way that you're trying to get the prize, if you will. And you have to want to do that. And so I think that might be a connection, and you might think it's a stretch. Nick especially might right now think it's a stretch since I was picking on him. In chapter 12, verse 1, we move to spiritual gifts. And Paul says this, "Now concerning spiritual gifts, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware." Which is a reminder that these are not just normal, ordinarily natural giftings. There is something different about a spiritual gift, and it may not be immediately obvious. And so Paul is going to begin to speak through this. Verse 4, there are varieties of gifts, but the same Spirit. There are varieties of ministries and the same Lord. There are varieties of effect, but the same God who works all things in all persons. Again, there's a potpourri. There is a smorgasbord. It's a buffet. But it looks like we're not the ones picking. It looks like there's servers behind the line, and we're being given spiritual gifts. That is what verse 7 tells us. Each one is given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. For to one is given the word of exhortation, and so on and so forth, and the listing of the gifts there. And you just see that idea that the gifts are given and the Spirit is at work. If you're sticking with me, verse 11. The one and same Spirit works all these things, distributing to each one individually just as he wills. So when we were back in earlier lessons, we were talking about the fact that not everybody may have the same number of gifts, not everybody may have the same intensity or perhaps even quality of gifts, but everyone has been given as the Lord has, what's the word, desires to give, such that the whole church is built up. Okay, so now that's just kind of background. What about this idea of passion? Well, verse 31 of chapter 12, I think, is one of the first verses that speaks to this. And if you just back up a little bit, we've got classes, if you will, of giftedness. And we kind of talked about this when I drew that triangle, or the pyramid, rather. So God's appointed, if you're looking at verse 28, in the church, first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, then miracles, then gifts of healings, helps, administrations, various kinds of tongues, or kinds of tongues would be more accurate there. All are not apostles, are they? All are not prophets, are they? All are not teachers, are they? All are not workers of miracles, are they? All do not have gifts of healings, do they? All do not speak with tongues, do they? All do not interpret, do they? And then verse 31, but earnestly desire the greater gifts. And now I will show you a still more excellent way. So this is, and then he moves on to the classic chapter of love, which he's going to argue is superior, because if you're involved in any of the gifts without love, you're just an empty gong or a clanging cymbal, which would be annoying after a while, right? And so so then he applies it. But if you apply it with love, all of the gifts began to bear fruit in the lives of the people that you're blessing. Then he moves back into spiritual gifts in verse 14, and he specifically is now talking about tongues, which could, of course, get us into a lot of discussion on that. But when you read chapter 14, Paul is very intentional about what he means by tongues. Like, there's, Paul is very clear that tongue speaking in chapter 14, for the most part, at one point he seems to evidence some sort of a spiritual prayer language. But in almost every case, what he's talking about is the ability to speak in a foreign language that you don't know, which is why he's talking about the unbelievers that are there are going to hear your words in their language, and it speaks to them powerfully. That's what happened at Pentecost initially. You can look back at that in Acts, and you'll see all of the foreigners were like, they were all amazed that they were hearing this word in their own tongues, in their own languages. It's the same word there. However you look at it, though, Paul is saying that tongue speaking doesn't do much for the building up of the body unless it's done in order, decently and in order. One person speaking, one person translating. Otherwise, the only people that are benefiting, this is the implication, is the one whose language that person is speaking in. All the rest of the congregation, without an interpreter, without a translator, isn't being benefited. They're not being grown up in their faith. But as he's talking about tongues, multiple times he kind of breaks out of that and goes a little bit general. Verse 12 of chapter 14 is one of those examples. So also you, since you are zealous of spiritual gifts, seek to abound for the edification of the church. Again, that call, like knowing that you are and ought to earnestly desire these spiritual, or zealous is the word here, then seek to the edification of the church. So you are to be earnest about spiritual gifts, and you're supposed to use them to build up the church. Verse 31 of that chapter, now he moves to speaking in tongues may not help everyone, but prophecy could, and so earnestly desire, or desire earnestly prophecy. That's verse 39, I believe, as he then moves the argument forward into the fact and the reality of Christ's resurrection in chapter 15. So verse 39, therefore, my brethren, desire earnestly to prophesy, and do not forbid to speak in tongues, but let all things be done properly and in an orderly manner. So Paul, as he's trying to clarify teaching on tongues, and obviously he devoted a whole chapter to it in his day, and it's still a point of contention and division among many denominations. But Paul's saying, one, don't forbid it, and two, it's to be done in a decent and orderly manner, because the point of spiritual gifts are for the building up of the church. They're not for the building up of our own individual persons. So they're to be done for and to others. And I think that's a key thing. So to be careful that I'll just end up on a rant here. If a person is only speaking in tongues as a personal prayer language, that may be the case. I'm not necessarily saying that's not possible. I think that's what Paul is cautioning against when he says don't forbid it. But I am telling you, it's not a spiritual gift for the building up of the church. It's just a personal enrichment time, which we need to be involved in, but that's not the same thing as exercising spiritual gifts, because spiritual gifts are for others, and it's the work of the Lord flowing through us. Another one of these in here, and I'm dropping exact references, but it's in these couple chapters, Paul talks about the fact that with spiritual gifts, the irony is the weaker ends up being more significant. The dishonorable oftentimes ends up receiving more honor. And so that's just an encouragement to everyone that this is the Lord working through us. And so it's not about our natural talents and gifts. It's about the work of the Lord through us. So if you feel called to something and you feel like the Lord has equipped you, but you're not sure of your own capacities, go for it and just let the Lord be your strength. And let him enable and empower you to that. So that's just kind of, as I was thinking about this desire for earnestly desire and zealous. Those phrases occur five or six times in these three chapters. And sometimes they're talking about a specific gift, and sometimes they're talking about just spiritual gifts in general. So that's my thought there. Comments. So, Nick, you look like you are almost. Do you want to say something? Okay. I think the answer. So, the question. This is for the mic. The question is a question about gifts of healing, and whether or not they're still in play or still valid for today. And if they're not, why are they not? And perhaps why didn't Paul specifically or others specifically say they've ceased? So that's a good question. And before, I answer that, this is one where I have to caveat a few things. First is I have to turn off the microphone. No, I'm just kidding. But so first off, as a gift, I believe healings have ceased. The gift of healing has ceased. I believe the gift of healing, like the gift of prophecy and all of the giftedness of miracles, were to authenticate the speaker. So your prophets in the Old Testament were able to float axe heads or call down fire or whatever, right? The amazing miracles that prophets could do in the Old Testament, and they're done, it's a test. If the prophet says something and it comes true, he's speaking my words. If he doesn't, he's not. Take him out back and stone him. If we would have that same application today, we would have very little people claiming to be prophets and miracle workers. Might actually be a good thing. But except I don't really want to do all the stoning. So now that the canon is complete, there is not the need to validate and authenticate the message. If somebody in here or myself or Lloyd or Ben is declaring the word, you know if my words are true because you're charged to compare it with the word. So I don't need to have to float an axe head for you to say, oh, he's believable. I just need to speak the word and then, you say, that tracks, okay? So there's not a need for that kind of giftedness. Now, do miracles still happen? I'll say yes. Do people still get healed? I will say yes, and even in ways that can't be explained. I already shared the story about one of our professors, a good friend of Lloyd's even, has come and spoken in this church in days past. Dan Doriani, Pete knows him as well, right? So I shared that story about he was involved in the laying of hands on someone and praying for their healing. And the healing occurred, and Dan and a couple other Reformed dudes were really surprised by that whole situation. Now, Dan has, all of those guys, I'm sure, left going, do I have the gift of healing? To find out that they didn't. Like, they can't touch and make well. And so that's the gift that I think has ceased. But I still think we're called, even in James, if anyone is ill, let him call the elders. Let him lay hands and anoint with oil. And after confession, and the Lord will hear their prayer and bring healing. So it seems like the Lord has said, this is how it can work. But, the reference there might be to Benny Hinn, I don't know, with the coat, where he just can slay folks. And as it touches them, they're healed. I would say that it seems to me that's fraudulent. So, Pete? Yes, and I would also say, that's right. That's a great reminder. That's a great reminder. There are still places in which they don't have the word to validate. And so it seems that God is pleased to use unexplainable or miraculous things to get the attention and to validate the authority of the speaker. I'll also say, Nick's referenced the idea of being Reformed or a Reformed position. A wise Reformed, what's that?
Or Calvinist.
The wise Calvinist, the wise Reformed person holds their truth like this. Not like this. Okay? Because there's a big difference between how you hold your truth. One, this looks really aggressive, so another story there. I was sharing, trying to understand the Muslim faith when I was in Afghanistan, and I had lunch with an interpreter, Muslim, Arabic, Afghani, and he was international in the sense that he had married a nominally Catholic woman and was exposed to the Catholic faith in that sense. And he told me, he said, you know, after looking around to ensure no one could possibly overhear him, he said very quietly, you know, I've made some observations. Christianity presents God like this. Islam presents God like this. And he said, I think God should be presented like this. And so, you know, I just asked if I could pray for his journey, and he said, later, when no one's looking. But that's an interesting observation, and I think theology needs to be presented that same way. So when you're in those situations, that enables you not to be surprised by a God, again, quoting C.S. Lewis, who's not a tame lion. Like, we don't have him figured out. So, Buck, or, yeah. Yeah. Adam, I mean, I think you're right in that we are all idolaters at heart, and we're very good to draw attention to ourselves, even with the gifts that we still have. I have to think about whether that's causal, like God knowing that because we're prone to do that, he eliminated it. Nonetheless, it's true. It's a true statement that if that gift was going, many of us would abuse that. And in fact, I don't think that gift exists today, at least not in the way that it was back then. And people still do make a lot of money off of that.
How many times have we all been guilty in order to
proclaim our faith? As opposed to saying, look what the Lord has done. Yeah, he took a cracked pot, a broken vessel like me, and used me. Worked through me to open someone's eyes to his glory. Yeah. So, but I think I saw your hand too.
Yeah. So,
yeah. That's an interesting observation. I appreciate with respect to the gifts we've been given. If we're unwilling to move in that direction, it is a stewardship issue. You are right. That is the guy that has simply buried the talent, if you will. And if we're willingly involved in utilizing those gifts, when the master comes back, he brings the reward. It's a good reminder. As we're jumping back into the notes to kind of finish out this week on connecting our passion with ministry, in your workbooks, you're on on or about page 41, again, plus or minus one or two for old or new copies. And we're doing those disconnecting links that disconnect us from the passion in ministry. Again, probably most of us, if you've been walking with the Lord for a while, you've certainly seen this in others, and perhaps you've felt it in your own life, where people they just stop serving for some reason. And so that's the, you know, why are people stopping in their service to the Lord? Why are they disconnecting from ministry? So in this book, we've gotten a couple things, just going through super quick to, in case you weren't here last week, and fill in the blanks. So connecting previous impact to passion. So the mistake here is sometimes we say, because this event had such a great impact on me, I'm obviously called to be involved in the same thing. And that can come about through the four subpoints: ministry, event, experience, or person. So it could be like, this person, guy, gal, whatever, really ministered powerfully in my life. I need to now serve them or serve alongside of them. Or it may be some sort of event. You know, I did this thing. It was amazing. So now, as a kid, I came to Christ. So now I have to be involved in that thing. And sometimes that works if it's aligned with who you are. But if it's not aligned with who you are, eventually you're going to find yourself burned out, just because you're emotionally reacting to something. I'm not saying don't. I'm just saying pay attention to what's happening. And if you're not aligned with your giftedness and your passion, then shift a little bit. Next arrow is guilt. You know, that's where you just, somebody asks you in such a way that you just feel guilty saying no, so you say yes. And that will work for a while. And sometimes, you know, you just got to do it. Hani's not here, but she works on Mondays and makes a lot of phone calls trying to remind people of things they had volunteered for. And she's like, oh, I know when people see my number, they probably are like, oh, no, Hani's calling. So if she calls you, say yes, even if you feel guilty. No, I'm kidding. But to the degree that you can say yes, do. And then think about whether you should be on that volunteer list in general. And if not, shift to another one. That's what I would say. The next arrow is other things. I won't speak on that this time. It's just other things. And then the last one is people. And that's kind of where we left off. I read the they are the very resourceful people. Those are the ones that ignite our passion. That's people that are experts in that thing. So if you've got a heart for missions and you spend time around John and Sam, then you're going to begin to cultivate that heart for missions, right? Because they have been and they love doing that thing. So if you feel like that might be something, and there are a couple in here that are on the missions committee. Most of the people on that committee have a heart for that, right? And so they're around people the next is the important people. They share our passion. So I gave the example, I don't think, Mike, you were here, but I gave the example of Turning Point, right? If the people that come to Turning Point suck life and joy out of us, but we share this passion. Now, for me, they're both also really resourceful people because they've walked the road longer than I have, and they know more about this than I do. So I'm benefiting from them as resourceful people, but also we're sharing this passion and this commitment. And, you know, I'm saying that lightly. There are so many times where we leave and we're surprised at the comments and the questions, and we're like, what are we? Is the Lord making a difference through us in their lives? This is amazing. And it really is. So, Mike, amen. When Susan and I were graduating from seminary and I was looking at some church planting areas, we were looking up in New England, and we were looking in Michigan and in Maryland. And in New England, one of the guys said, ministry here is a lot like breaking rocks. Okay. So, you know, it's that. So it's just the, you know, what used to be an area of our country that was passionate about the Lord, and now they're passionate about other things. So, but the important thing is in the ministries that you're involved in, you need a couple of those resourceful people that can fuel or ignite your passion, and you definitely need a couple of the important people that share that ministry. So you can go to a conference and you can benefit from the experts that speak, but you can also benefit from the people that are just seated right around you. So then the next group are the trainable people. They're the ones that catch your passion. When I was young, the navigators, they were always looking for fat people. This doesn't work today. But faithful, available, and teachable. That's we're always looking for folks. And you're like, okay. So, but faithful, available, and teachable. That's who you, as you begin to grow in a ministry, so whatever the ministry is that you want to get involved in the local church or in the community or in the greater church, you want to, as soon as you can, find somebody that you're recognizing as teachable and begin to invest your life and what you know into their life. And you might only be a half a step ahead of them, but it's not, but it's not too early to be involved in discipling others. And anyone that's taught, right, knows that you learn when you teach. So, and so that's just a joy that you're involved in their lives and they're benefiting from that. So that's the trainable people. The nice people just enjoy our passion. They're the ones that just say pleasant and kind things to you when they see, hey, that was really nice. And it feels nice and to get that. So they don't necessarily drain from your ministry, you know, from what you're doing. They're not necessarily building you up other than just a nice encouragement. So I've got a lot of examples in that, but I ought not give them. So just for interest of time, I think we understand that. And then the last is the drainable people. And this is the one we've already spoken about. If you're only around people that are taking your passion, you will get burned out. I mean, that's just going to happen. So you have to, there is a sense in which there's a tank, and the more drainable people you have in your life, the more holes are in your tank. And so you can handle a lot of holes in your tank if you have a lot gumming into your tank. So that would be an example of if you're involved in refuge ministry, if you're involved in Turning Point, if you're involved in ministries that are probably a lot of the diaconal work, it's just really, it's draining. Not that it's bad, it's just draining. Your sleeves are rolled up and you're involved in the brokenness of people's lives. And I've talked to some of the mentors, and the times that they spend with some of their clients is absolutely amazing. You know, 10, 15, 20 hours in a week trying to walk with someone through a crisis is so necessary, so important, and that person has to figure out how to be refreshed and to be encouraged. And so think about the ministries that you're excited about and passionate about, and think about the people that might be draining from you. They might be the clients or the individuals you're serving, or they might just be people that you're working with. I'm not saying don't work with them. I'm just saying there's a cost there. So recognize the cost and then look for ways to be refueled and fed by the Lord through these resourceful people and, that ignite, and also those that share your passion. So that's my challenge. Yeah, Kim. Good questions. The whole point of this is to speak exactly to Sam what you were saying. That take a look at the ministries you're involved in and ask yourself, is this only draining or is it draining and refreshing? Because that's the case with Turning Point, right? It is draining and it's also refreshing. And then because it's a team effort, then we get the advantage of sharing that passion and learning from each other as well. So because I think that's one of the things is we're also, you know, this is definitely an aside, but we're built for community. That's who we are, right? Didn't ask for permission to share this from Laura, but I think it's okay. Laura's reading a book right now called Leading with Honor. And in it, it's a leadership lesson from one of the guys that spent a bunch of years in the Hanoi Hilton in Vietnam. And so he talks about a torture and then shares a leadership lesson. The worst punishment is solitary confinement, where basically all they do is they don't necessarily torture you. I mean, that usually happens before, but they'll pitch you into a dark, small space for a long time, and that's the worst punishment, because we're created for community. So, you know, of course, the prisoners then tried to figure out how to, when they're walking by, they would sing songs really loud changing the words maybe to try to communicate some message of encouragement, knowing that as soon as they were understood, they would be beaten. But it was still so important to them. So that's just one of those, the realities that if you're trying to do ministry alone, you really have to pay attention to the draining aspects of it. And better yet, find somebody who's teachable and then debt. But I saw your hand, but let me just press for a minute, and then if I get it, I'll come back to you. So to wrap up about people, the next dark bolded triangle is overcommitment. I just want to say the old adage, when you say yes to something, you have by default said no to something else. It's just the way it is, right? We only have 23 or 24, sometimes 25 hours in a day. And you can't do 30 hours of work in a 24-hour day. You just can't. And so, and a lot of folks make the mistake of, again, kind of another, I guess, trite, but it's true. We say yes to things that are good, and therefore we end up saying no to things that are great or excellent. So the point of this is think through what might be the great ministries for you to be involved in and do those. So just think about whether or not you're overcommitted. On the other side is boredom. That's the next bullet. We are created to be in community. And if you look at your week and realize that all of your non-work time is just centered around the things you like to do for yourself, that's a stewardship issue, so of the time and the talents that God's given you. So if you're bored in that sense, we're designed to stretch ourselves, we're designed to grow, and if you've watched things grow, if you have kids or you remember your kids, when they go through growth spurts, sometimes it actually hurts. And so that's just kind of an interesting thing. But we're designed, living things grow. Growing can be painful. So stretch yourself. And then the last bullet is incompetence. The Peter principle, which is not named after the Apostle Peter. It's named after Peter Lawrence Peter. It was like a business guru guy in the 60s. He determined that even really competent people, they hit a point, if you keep adding to their, you know, responsibilities, I think we think this is what happens. They get to some point, and then they just can't take any more. If you try to give them more, they'll just keep falling back to this level, right? I think that's what we think would happen. But actually what happens is, you know, as people are growing up, if you give them two more, they go like that and find some. They'll level out at some level of incompetence if you don't recognize this spot. If as soon as you recognize it, you pull that back off the plate, you can kind of get something at a higher level of performance. That's just to say that, and I suppose even if you're, you know, if a person peters out and just totally quits, I don't know. This anecdotally, it would think if you paid good attention to that in yourself, you can kind of start over and start working your way back up. So that's just the recognition that as you grow in ministry and you're having people you're working with, pay attention to these kinds of things in their lives and pay attention to it as well in yours. Because you don't want to push people beyond what they can handle just because you want something done. So that's the charge there. They're still great people. If you've seen this happen, it's not because, you know, they hate you or there turns out they weren't all that great. It's just you found their level in which they just literally can't do anymore. And so that's the challenge there. So, all right, we're coming up on time here. If in your hand manual, I'm just going to show what mine looks like. On pages 42 and 43 or thereabouts, you got these two charts, and this is an opportunity for you to highlight the gifted areas on the one side with the passion areas on the other, or the passion areas on one side and the abilities on the other, and kind of see where they line up. And then the X's in the box are just where they often match up. So oftentimes a person that has a passion of the challenging kind is also shows itself in evangelism or in faith or in discernment and those kinds of things. So this is just, the only thing I would say about this is if you correlate the scores that you had, both top and bottom, and as you kind of see where they intersect, if there are no X's anywhere, then take a look back at those tools, those inventory tools that you took. Just kind of say, did I answer, like, all of these inventories, tests, whatever, assessments, there are only pictures of how you answered them on the day you answered them, which may reflect, the way you actually think real time, over time, but it may also just be the way you were that morning. You might have suffer from a bit of undigested potato. Anybody know the reference? Yes! All right. So that's that there. The next one, some people are wondering, the Christmas Carol, right? Yeah, the Ghost of Marley might just be, there's more about gravy than ghost. Okay, anyway, and then on page 44, the last one is that those same passions with your personality assessment, the DISC, the D-I-S-C. So again, this is only just speaking to areas that are likely matched up. If you get all unlikelies or a lot of unlikelies, that would be another time where I would say just take one or both of those inventories again and pay and see if you're paying attention to them. So, all right, so there's just kind of reflection there for you. The reminder, in the bold thing, transfer the people you choose to demonstrate passion for along with ways you demonstrate passion. Oh, that's just a note, which we're going to do later. I brought those things today, but I decided not to pass them out, so I'm going to do this next time. This is what it eventually, it's in one spot. You're going to eventually be able to transfer your stuff on too. But I've got some administrative stuff to talk about this, and I thought it would be better to do it next week when we've got 2 weeks off after that. So that way, if you're a latecomer to the class and you haven't done any of these assessments, you can kind of do it and catch up. So, all right, let me just close in prayer, and then we'll head off to church or whatever. So let's pray. Father, thank you again for this time together to just take a look and just to be in discussion about these things. And so, Lord, what we ask is that you work your will out in our lives and you use us to be a blessing to others for the building up of your body, the church. Father, thank you again for how you've created us. Help us to stay in community, to be aware of ourselves and others and their needs, and use us to be a blessing to one another. We pray all this in Jesus' name and for his sake. Amen.